As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
I am psyched because we have here in the studio Rory K. Smith and Alison Rudd, which generally makes for a very good podcast, and we are privileged to be joined on the phone by Mr. Matt Hughes. Now, in a minute, we'll be talking about Pardew and Stamford Bridge sounding empty and all that good stuff. But first, let's head to the northwest for the Manchester derby.
Fernando finding Yaya Toure. Oh, Di Maria slid in and made no contact. Clichy pulls it back. And Aguero scores. Finally, the breakthrough for Manchester City with Kun Aguero's 12th goal of the season. And the resistance of the 10 men is finally breached.
Alison, I want to get this out of the way first. This sort of bizarre interpretation afterwards, or these two different interpretations. I encountered a lot of United fans who talk about how there's obvious progress. Yeah, they lost, and Van Gaal made the point too. They took on Chelsea and City, the two best teams in the Premier League, arguably, and the games are really, really close. And I'm wondering, would it be churlish to point out to him that they got a point from the Chelsea game at home because of an improbable last-ditch winner, and there were at least three penalties that City should have had. I mean, they could have absolutely been toasted in this game.
Yeah, you could probably make good cases for both scenarios. Did they ride their luck in both matches, or are there signs that they're improving? I think what the signs are of is that there keep being problems at Old Trafford. It's usually just there's another injury, yet another injury. And a reshuffling of a defence, which has been all season slightly peculiar. They didn't buckle under that at the Etihad. And I think if you wanted to look at the optimistic things, you would point to the spirit and the energy of defending. And Smalling took that slightly too far. But him aside, I thought a peculiar backline defended reasonably well. There was optimism in the way they played. There was energy. So if pushed, I would say I would come out of that if I was wanting to see signs of encouragement under Van Gaal that there is something going on there. They're not getting panicky. There's no sense of hesitancy. There's no self-doubt. Whatever he's saying to them, they seem to believe in themselves. There was that run from Rooney, which, you know, it's the sort of run you get from a player playing in a team that are top of the league and are in three competitions and believe they can do anything. There is good spirit there for a team that are underperforming for the outlay they've put in.
You're talking about the run where he toasted
company,
and then he for some reason.
Well, he should have shot first time, but apart from the final second of that move, it was brimming with brio.
Matt, you finished the game with an unusual back four of Valencia, Paddy McNair, Michael Carrick, and Luke Shaw, and it's weird and it's unusual. The fact that they defended well, according to Alison, when I think there might be some doubt about that when they were supposed to have conceded three penalties and red card. But does it mean anything when in fact it's not going to be these guys playing when United actually become good, or is it?
I think Alison's right to an extent. They show good spirit and the signs Van Gaal is building something, but they're still a long way away from where they have been in the past and where they would aspire to be. I guess the difference is last year the big games against City and Liverpool, they got absolutely hammered. This year they've been more competitive, so I guess that is a sign of some progress in difficult circumstances.
There were games earlier this year that United lost when I thought they actually played relatively well. And now this one is like, oh, look, we only lost 1-0 and we didn't capitulate at the end. And I'm like, yeah, but Michael Oliver had an absolute stinker. Those were three absolute stonewall penalties. Rojo could have been sent off as well.
What if you give the penalty, you have to send him off?
Well, in theory, although you're supposed to give them, I mean, I don't know if he didn't see them or if he saw them and he just judged them differently or whatever. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, if things had gone against you, you could have easily lost this game 3-4-0 and maybe you would have shown the same fight back and the same reaction at the end, but we wouldn't be talking about it because of the heavy scoreline.
I think it's interesting with United, the kind of perspective that it's a slightly misleading statistic, this idea that they've had a worse start than they did under Moyes. But just as, I don't know, just as with Moyes, it felt like there was a groundswell of opinion that there was no progress being made. With Van Gaal, you do wonder whether people think there's more progress being made than there actually is. Do they have? They have only got 13 points from 10 games, which is not very good. They're fortunate to an extent that apart from Chelsea and Southampton, everybody is waiting for them. So even, I mean, I think are they now? They're 10 points behind City, but Liverpool and Arsenal, they're not sort of miles and miles ahead. Spurs are around the same mark as Liverpool, United, and Everton. I think that's helping. But I don't know, you just wonder, the United start, for everything that's been dressed up as signs of progress, are they really there? I don't know. They've got better players. They spent more money than any team has ever spent in one transfer window. And the reward is 13 points from 10 games. In terms of the defence, is there any reason why the defence should be as, you know, as bad now as it was last year? Not really. I know they've had injuries, but I think people want to see progress because it is Van Gaal. Whether that progress is actually there, I'm not sure.
Matt, is there something at work here where, you know, last year, because it was David Moyes, and you know, who's highly respected and so on, but isn't Van Gaal, we tended not to buy into this idea that, you know, everything will be fine. I mean, he came out after the game, and Van Gaal says, oh, yes, you know, we're really close to where we want to be, everything's going to be okay. You want to believe him because he has a track record and he's done it in the past. Is that part of it? Is this part of the value added that a Van Gaal brings, that he can say stuff like that and you buy into that?
Well, he's got instant credibility, which is what David Moyes really struggled for. I think the context of last year is crucial to understanding the current mood around United. It cannot be as bad as that. So there's just such a desire and desperation for things to improve, and that explains the positivity.
I mean, I've only seen him in the flesh since he came back, but when there was the 2-2 draw at the Hawthorns, and he even sits there and says, yes, 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 I know I'm arrogant, yes, I know I'm big-headed, but I'm always right. And the Mourinho aside, and he has a different brand of arrogance, you sort of think, well, I can picture what it's like in the dressing room at Old Trafford. You know, he's just got this amazing belief in what he's doing and the project he's going to unfold there. And I think that's why a lot of people are buying into this being not a dreadful season, really, and there are signs of progress because of the personality of the manager.
But it's a bit dangerous, though, because, I mean, he's 63 years old now, and situations like this, you benefit from the confidence and everything, and then all of a sudden when that confidence fails, it tends to happen with dramatic effect. I mean, when you know that's where you get the emperor has no clothes syndrome, if at some point these things don't come together.
Well, yeah, but football is perception, isn't it? I think that's what maybe the really interesting thing about United is. Results are broadly similar. There are as many pros and cons to their play under Van Gaal as there were under Moyes. They're playing a nicer style, but they still look kind of disjointed and the bits don't really fit together. But because it's Van Gaal, everyone thinks, well, there must be a master plan. Whereas with Moyes, everyone thought, well, there can't be master plans, we're not sure. So Van Gaal has that initial, yeah, as Alison says, I think seduced is the right word. He's kind of seduced people into thinking he will get it right. And don't get me wrong, he may get it right. It may well be that there is this upward curve. But I'm not quite sure whether the things that we're seeing there as, you know, signs for positive signs. It's not like under Moyes there was never any kind of spirit or determination to get back into it. Do you know what I mean? It just seems a bit... I think it was the QPR game I listened to on the radio when they won 4-0 against a terrible team. And I think it was Jonathan Pearce doing the commentary for 5 Live. They scored one, and they obviously hadn't been playing that well. You'd never quite tell from the radio. And he started talking about, the barrage is coming, the floodgates have opened, blah, 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 blah. And he sort of thought that would happen to no other team than this United this season. That there was this assumption that, oh, United have scored once now, they will just fly away. And they didn't. QPR had a couple of chances to get back into it, and eventually they got four. And I just feel as though people are kind of seeing what they want to see in United.
But
at the moment.
It's not that illogical, Rory. It's not like Van Gaal's in charge of Burnley and he's got £7 million worth of players. He has an array of, some of it's quite amazing, talent
he does,
at his disposal.
Yeah.
So if you've got that, plus a manager who has a track record and a manager who has arrogance, self-belief and some sort of charisma and clearly is taking the dressing room with him. Yes, we all know the defence, there are problems, so not all of his own making. Although I liked the interview with Rummenigge when he says he just doesn't care about the defence. That isn't so ridiculous that most of us have bought into it.
I don't think it's ridiculous, I just think it's interesting.
Apart from Gab.
No, I just look at this and I watched the highlights again last night and they showed United's chances. And I may be forgetting something, but there was the Di Maria shot, which was a very good save from Hart. There was Rooney nutmegging Company, who still somehow managed to get an 8 in most newspapers. And there was this guy, there was a great chance. There was Fellaini running away from Company and getting that header in, which comes off his shoulder. I'm thinking myself, I mean, is there another great chance that I'm forgetting here?
I don't think so.
Was there some other great creation here? And this was against a City team who were really low on confidence and who I don't think, I mean, they played particularly well, or rather, they were very effective at first and they created, and then they should have had those penalties. Then after the red card, it looked to me like they were sort of like, oh, no, let's not mess this up. And they just kept retreating and United, to their credit, kept fighting.
The mitigating circumstances, which is simply ignoring that they had 10 men for an hour, and generally it's Van Gaal's first season, it's a new team. The sort of heart and soul was ripped out of the club last year. To expect them to suddenly be up there charging for the title.
No. Hang on. Sorry if I jump in here, Matt. I don't expect them to be charging to this title. I'm saying in this specific game, where were all the wonderful chances that they created?
Except for the
ones that I mentioned. One off the shoulder, one Rooney not getting a shot off, and then the Di Maria chance, which I thought was an excellent chance.
The point is, when they went to City last year, they were absolutely annihilated. They were down to 10 men for an hour, and they managed to remain competitive, which, given where they've been recently, is some progress.
Right, I'm assuming nobody wants to defend or even talk about Chris Smalling other than to say he was, as Van Gaal put it very honestly, was stupid.
That's a fairly succinct explanation.
Look, I am curious about one thing with the guy. I've never met him, but I've seen him interviewed, and he was presented as somebody who's actually very clever and
he's meant to be,
studious and everything. Was it just the adrenaline in the game? I mean, you suppose so, right?
I think Smalling, I can't remember whether Ollie Kay or James Ducker wrote it this morning. I think Smalling struggles when he's in a high-stakes game. I think his nerve goes. And you wonder whether, this is sort of Todd psychology, but you wonder whether it's because of his footballing background that, you know, he came up through the lower leagues from Maidstone United to Fulham. He had this relatively quick jump from playing non-league football to playing Premier League reserve team football, then being at Manchester United. And you wonder whether he hasn't quite got the mental fortitude, I guess, to cope with those really high pressure situations.
Yeah, there's something about when you're bought by a big club and they say, it's okay, you can stay a bit longer at the club you're at because we know you're not quite ready. I think that might mess with your head slightly.
Talking about City, it was presented as some kind of crisis, and it was kind of three pretty bad performances in a row, or certainly three bad results in a row, from CSKA Moscow to the League Cup, where they did put out a reasonable side, and of course in between the West Ham loss. Matt, did they convince you of anything?
Well, I never really thought they were in the midst of a huge crisis. Equally, I've not been that impressed by what I've seen so far, and if Aguero wasn't playing so well, that they'd be even worse off. He really is. Everyone talks about Torre, but he really is key for City to me, and when he was injured last year, probably why they made such hard work of winning the league. Again, it's all about perspective and perception, I think. Pellegrini pointed out they had the same points this time last season. They were 6 points off the pace and went on to win the league. The difference is they were six points behind an Arsenal team that, in my view and in the view of most people, was kind of waiting to sort of not quite implode, but certainly weren't going to run away with the league. Whereas this year, they're up against what looked to me like an outstanding Chelsea team, and I don't think they're going to let them back in.
What are you guys on Aguero? Because I was just wondering who the best player in the Premier League is. And I kind of feel like because of his injuries, because he's got great players around him at City, he's somebody I always thought of as being in the conversation, but perhaps, and also, of course, in years past, we had Luis Suarez and Gareth Bale and the other guys who bolted to La Liga. But is Aguero there or thereabouts, as you people like to say?
Yeah, he is. But I thought this last night, actually. You wonder whether, is he the Real Madrid signing for next summer? Because they've been after him for an awfully long time. There's nobody else out there who you really look at and think, yeah, he's the one. He's got 10 or 11 already. Aguero.
I think his presence might unsettle Benzema, so I'm not sure.
Me. Yeah, but Perez has got an uneasy relationship with Benzema. But yeah, Aguero, it's hard to see past him as the best player in the league at the moment.
Final word on Manchester United. I looked at the game and I thought Marouane Fellaini, much derided, was going to get dumped or would have been dumped on your mate Rafa in Napoli if he'd not got himself injured at the end. He actually was a big, important physical presence. And in a game in which Di Maria was less than his brilliant self, I thought he provided real added value.
When he came on against West Brom, he had an immediate aerial impact, and then he dropped deep, and it all didn't make any sense at all why you would do that. I mean,
he was following instructions from Van Gaal.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The reintegration seemed a bit complicated. He does what he does well. The trouble is, because they're so biased in terms of attackers, he probably will get used occasionally to play deeper, where I think he's much less effective. He needs to be harassing defenders and doing well at set pieces and just making a nuisance of himself. But not spitting, obviously. We don't want him doing that.
Yeah, well you brought it up. You want to talk about it? It is interesting with HDTV and Vines and everything, that everything's recorded, Husey. I think even 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have been having the social media debate about whether he was spitting or indeed the Joe Hart face-to-face thing with Oliver, I thought was interesting too, because if you look at it, it looks bad. But then if you look at the reaction immediately, if you look at the whole sort of sequence, if you look at him immediately before and immediately after and Oliver's reaction, it casts in a very different light. It's not some aggressive headbutt on the referee.
That's the problem with taking a snapshot, isn't it? Because I suspect Joe Hart, he is a very polite man, and I suspect his words at the moment he was leaning into the referee were probably not overly aggressive, and the referee did not feel intimidated, and there was no actual contact. It's just that if you get a frame and you freeze it, it can look worse than it is. I mean, Joe Hart doesn't go around headbutting referees. That's a ridiculous accusation.
Dumont on the overlap. Sissoko again. Moreno is there. But so too is Perez. The young Spaniard scores for the second week running. But that's a shocker for Alberto Moreno. He's gifted Newcastle the lead.
Right, moving on to Newcastle and Liverpool. Now, for some reason at St. James Park, and I noticed this in the Liverpool game, I didn't notice this previously, the penalty spots and the centre circle aren't filled in. There's just kind of like an outline of a circle. I have to say, maybe this is normal, and other people have told me that, well, you don't need to fill them in, and people have joked, obviously, that it's Ashley saving money and whatever else. I don't remember seeing this elsewhere. Have you?
No. And I have to admit, I didn't notice. I didn't notice that they weren't filled in. Isn't that awful?
Did anybody else notice it?
Truthfully, no.
All right, well, go back and look at it. Husey, you can direct people, and no doubt, to all sorts of illegal
streaming
sites.
But it sounds
sites.
Illegal to me. When I took my course, you wouldn't have got away with an really? Empty circle of anything.
Does the referee fill the circle in himself, or does the ground staff do that, presumably?
No.
The ground staff do it. It was just a bizarre
thing.
Does
the referee have to, inspect it to make sure it's there?
He does.
Sure
he has
there,
to
yeah.
inspect the posts and that the nets yeah. are in properly. And there's no
post.
Sharp edges.
That's
and there's
definitely
no
a post, yeah.
bottle tops on the pitch. La-di-da.
People are talking about an Alan Pardew revival and everything's fine again. It's not really all fine again, is it, Husey?
It's not. Well, the club isn't fine. I think Pardew is a decent manager working under almost impossible circumstances. Newcastle were never as bad as their own fans were painting, nor are they suddenly going to surge at the table and qualify for Europe again. He's not really the answer, but he's not the problem either. The problem is the ownership. That's not going to change. So I think, while it might be unpalatable for the fans in the short term, they're probably better off sticking with Pardew and maybe reviewing again in the summer. He will keep them in the Premier League. I wouldn't worry about that. Bigger question about what is the point of Newcastle for? What do they exist for? They're not going to win anything. They're probably not going to get relegated. They don't like cup competitions, it seems. So you can understand why there's this sort of perpetual misery surrounding the place.
I'm going to play devil's advocate again, and I'll wear my Mike Ashley hat, and I'll go and say, you know what? You go back to the owners you had before I came here, and you go look at how they ran the club, and feel free to Google them, and Mallorca, and brothels, and all this stuff, and they were from Newcastle. So I come from the outside. I limit your losses. I make this club sustainable, or close to sustainable. I get you promoted from the championship. We don't spend absurd amounts of money. You guys don't like me, but the fact of the matter is, I don't want to go and lose $50 million a year trying to compete to become Tottenham or something. So enjoy it. You guys all say you're loyal fans and you love showing up. I give you a Premier League team that you can show up and support every week. And look, there's even kids from the youth team like Tyler Dummett and stuff like that that you can go and enjoy watching. So what's the problem?
Well, as long as they finish above Sunderland, there's no problem at all for most Newcastle fans, I'd have thought.
I think in sort of a cold logic sense, you're probably right that he the job he's done in terms of turning the club into a sustainable model is quite admirable. There's certain things he's done that I think you can understand why Newcastle fans get upset. I think there's a PR issue that makes it sound kind of irrelevant. There's an issue that Ashley basically gives the impression he doesn't really care what the fans think, which I would suggest is not a great way to endear yourself to a local populace. And it's not just Newcastle this applies to. As Hughesy says, that group of teams who are not going to win anything, whether they care about cups or not is, I think, to an extent irrelevant, because I think fans now are conditioned not to care about the cups. They don't associate the cups with being successful, that they would enjoy it momentarily. I don't think it would buy a manager a huge amount of time anywhere. But what is the point? What are you going for? And that is an issue that I think is true across football.
Is it realistic that an owner would sit, and he goes to most games at the moment, it seems, he would sit there and boo the manager? I mean, he's, what do you expect him to do? No, he either sticks with the manager or he doesn't. And if he's going to stick with the manager, and we usually say that's a good thing, I think it's completely illogical that an owner should be expected to sack a manager just because there's a few banners and or very well organised
protests
saying don't.
No, it's not the Pardew issue that I think is the disconnect between Ashley and the fans. It's things like the renaming of St James's Park, the Wonga deal, all of that. He's obviously a brilliant
businessman.
But the placards
weren't about Wonga, they were about Pardew.
No, I know, but the Newcastle fans seem to be the discontent with the ownership, I guess because, and I don't want to speak on behalf of Newcastle fans, it's because they know the owner's going nowhere, so the discontent manifests itself as dislike for the manager. I think they know the owner is the issue. But Ashley just generally gives the impression that he doesn't really care he doesn't care if he's popular or not, and I don't think that's, not that he should do things to be popular, but I think you can understand why Newcastle fans have taken against him so much, despite the fact that financially, yeah, they're in a better position than they were.
Hughesy, isn't it remarkable how at this Liverpool...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dominated sports section. We've managed to avoid talking about Liverpool thus far, and I want to keep that going just as long as I can. I thought it was a pretty horrible game, and then I'll show all my bias. There was the Daryl Yamat on Mario Balotelli tackle, and I kind of thought, had that tackle been on, say, Sergio Aguero, might it have been treated differently by the referee?
I don't think so. I think he made two poor decisions. I thought that Sissoko foul on Joe Allen was even worse. Proper studs up, high, leg breaker, potential leg breaker. and I think both of them should have been shown red cards. Referees make mistakes. I don't think it's anything to do with the identity of the victim.
Especially as Aguero did not have two clear penalties against him given.
Right, but
strange analogy, I'm just saying, strange analogy. On a weekend when Aguero was hacked down and didn't get anything.
I watched this game on television. I didn't like the commentary, so I flipped over to another feed where there are other commentators. And then I flipped over to a third feed, and I didn't like any of it, frankly. But I also, maybe it was just because it was just such an awful
well,
game.
You were looking for a commentator who was going to big it up and say this was the best Newcastle-Liverpool game he'd ever seen.
Actually, it was the opposite. It was one specific commentator who kept telling me what a wonderful game this was when it was actually really, really turgid. Liverpool were terrible. I don't think Newcastle, I thought, deserved to win, but I didn't think they were much better. What's the problem with Liverpool, Dr. Smith?
How long we got?
Let's try to be brief. Can we agree that maybe this week the new centre forward wasn't the problem on his own?
The new centre forward has not been the problem. He's not covered himself in glory, Balotelli, but the new centre forward is distracting a lot from the main issues. The problems are the defence isn't very good. Rodgers can't organise a defence. The midfield has stopped pressing and tackling, which means the defence is exposed. The goalkeeper is not very good. There is a complete disconnect between how Rodgers wants to play football and the players he now has. His substitutions are uninspired. He can't produce a tactical switch. He's facing a very exacting challenge that he has to match, basically. There are problems at every level with Liverpool. The injuries to Sturridge hasn't helped particularly. I got in trouble for saying this the other day. I can't remember a team that was as exciting as Liverpool were last season becoming so boring overnight as they have. I realise the loss of Suarez and Sturridge is a factor in that, but then surely it's Rodgers' job as a manager to ensure that if you do have those two losses for various reasons, that the style, the philosophy that he talked about is maintained. And I think that I'm not going to say one way or the other whether he can meet the challenge, but it's a massive challenge for him now to prove that he is the manager that he was described as and that you get the impression he thinks he is.
Cusy, it sounds to me like he's blaming Brendan Rodgers. Is Rory being sizist here?
He's the manager, so ultimately the buck does stop with him in Rodgers' defence. The way things have panned out this season, his job could scarcely have been more difficult, really. You've got huge expectations from last year. Weighed against that, you've got the additional challenge of the Champions League. You've lost one of the best players in the world. Your main strikers barely play for injury. You've got lots of new signings, haven't really gelled. I mean, as a manager, challenges don't get much more difficult, frankly, and he struggled. It's not really a surprise that he struggled. I remember last season in March saying something like, I wouldn't be surprised if Liverpool won the league this season and went outside the top four the coming one. Are you this one? So far, it looks like I've nearly proved right. And it's sort of almost go back to basics and go back to where they were 2 years ago and start trying to build something. Use that Anfield as a, you know, fortress, use that dreadful cliche, and you know, go game by game instead of deluding themselves that they're a big team, a top four team, a top two team like they were last year, because at the moment they're not.
All right, easy one sentence answer here, Husey. If Liverpool finish outside the top four and they don't reach the quarterfinals of the Champions League and there are no more major injuries and the injured guys come back but show no evident signs of progress, do you look for a new manager?
No, of course not.
Would it be insane to fire this man if, given all the money that's been spent and whatever else, they show no signs of progress this year and they finish outside the top four?
I don't think it would be unreasonable to fire him.
Aha, we have a difference of opinion here.
The leap to managing Liverpool, he got quite lucky, and now it's tricky. Now there's stuff to do. He's not coping very well, I don't think. I mean, the fact that he keeps putting Joe Allen in midfield, who else other than him thinks Joe Allen is a top midfielder who fits into what Liverpool need at the moment?
Does he have anybody? I mean, you guys would know Liverpool better than me, but apart from Lucas, who has his issues, and the giant midfielder we saw in the League Cup, you know what I'm talking about, right? Mm. His name escapes me.
Jordan
right
something, I can't remember his surname now.
Does he have too many other options? And
no, but then that is an issue. That's
Chan's injured, right?
That is another issue.
No,
Chan's
not injured,
back.
And he looks good to me. He's got
Chan was injured.
Lots more
he was
energy.
Injured. Can I just say, I think I fall between two stools here. I think that Rodgers is struggling with what, as Husey says quite rightly, is a big challenge. I think it would be, whether it's silly or not to sack him in the summer is irrelevant. They will not sack him in the summer. I'd be staggered if FSG, having bought into him so completely, sacked him in the summer. I think that's probably a good thing. He should get that fourth season I suppose, to see whether last year was the fluke or this year was the fluke. And then at the end of that season, when we know that, then that's when you make your decision. I think that's fair. He'd have had 4 years.
Chelsea beat QPR, but it's very flat. And by the way, shout out to Charlie Austin, who I thought was magnificent with his little clever flick for the goal. But Mourinho talked about the team being flat afterwards, and then all of a sudden he comes out with the fact that it's the fault of Stamford Bridge, not as in the physical place, but he said it felt empty because there's a lack of atmosphere and the fans aren't noisy. And having been to Stamford Bridge several times this season for league games against supposedly less fancy opposition, like Leicester and whatnot, I can see where he's coming from. Chelsea struggled and they didn't get a massive lift from the crowd. All that said, is this a fair criticism? Are you comfortable with a manager basically calling out his own fans, Hughesy?
Yeah, because it's a good talking point. It's a great headline, and it happens to be true. What amused me is the sort of reaction from Chelsea fans, which has sort of almost been to ignore this criticism. Can you imagine the reaction if Rafa had said this a couple of years ago? That he'd have needed Rory as his 24-hour security man. He's right and he's wrong. I mean, the atmosphere at Stamford Bridge is rarely great, particularly not against on afternoon games against teams they expect to beat. There's a sense of entitlement. They expect to turn up and be entertained and to win, and largely they are. I say it's not just a Chelsea issue. You go to Arsenal for a routine league game and the atmosphere is, if anything, worse, largely because they get very nervous if they're not winning after by half-time.
So is it, I mean, you mentioned two clubs there. You're a Yorkshireman yourself. Is it a whole sort of soft southern London issue?
No, because the best atmosphere, or among the best atmospheres in London, is at
West Ham.
Tottenham and QPR pretty much always noisy. Might be a class issue. You do tend to get wealthier fans at Chelsea and Arsenal than you do elsewhere in the capital.
Well, that doesn't work, does it? Because sometimes at Stamford Bridge, the atmosphere is rocking. It's fantastic,
and it's the same
wealth bracket of fans, and presumably they're probably slightly richer when it's a big game and the ticket prices go up, and it's harder to get hold of a ticket, so you pay the touts more money to get in. It's probably a lot about the fact that Chelsea don't play that way. They're quite contained a lot of the time. They do just enough, and there's a sense that. Well, if they get a lead, they're quite happy just to go through the motions and play 5 out of 10 football till they need to do something different. And that doesn't inspire a crowd to make any noise.
I think this is an issue that goes way beyond Chelsea, style of football, Arsenal, class of fans, London. It's pretty much every... There's no ground in the Premier League where the atmosphere is consistently really good. So the two best are Stoke and West Brom, I think.
Crystal Palace is good.
Stoke has got much worse. If you go to the Britannia now, it's much quieter than it was 4 or 5 years ago. I think it's partly to do with the cost of tickets. I think people generally feel that if you've paid 30, 40, 50 quid, you're more likely to turn up and expect that the team in front of you that you've paid to watch, that much money to watch, should be entertaining you rather than might entertain you, which is what the expectation is if it's cheaper. I think that we watch so much football now that it's much harder to get excited about things. I think we're all so aware of what brilliant football looks like that if it's not brilliant, then we kind of go, oh, this isn't really good. I think we're much more easily bored. I think people are more easily distracted in life in general. I think the football
probably... smartphones in the stadium and good connectivity.
Things like that probably don't help, yeah. There was that banner at PSV, wasn't there, where it said... when they put Wi-Fi in the stadium and the fans made it pretty clear they didn't want Wi-Fi in the stadium, they weren't there to check their emails. I think that's a huge factor. I think there's loads and loads of stuff, and it's not just about how football's changed. I think it's partly about how society's changed.
Yeah, you're right. It's called the nativity play thing, where you go along as the parent to watch your little one in their first ever production, and you don't watch it, you film it. And there is a sense that we're all doing two things at once and thinking about how we're going to react to something, rather than what is really needed at a football match is to give yourself... over to give yourself to it completely. It's one of those mad, wonderful parts of your life where you just start screaming for no reason. And that's what used to make football so amazing, was that you'd get grown men trudging in from a hard week work and they'd just let go in a legitimate way.
Right, but
total passion. But no one has total passion anymore because they are too busy doing other stuff.
The pit's closed and everything. This whole, like,
the pits didn't have Wi-Fi.
No, that's fine. But I'm saying as a foreigner looking at this, I am struck. I have noticed. I mean, I attended my first game, and it was at Stamford Bridge. Sorry, it wasn't. It was at Sellers Park. But in 1989, while people say that, you know, that was supposedly some kind of golden era, it certainly was a lot noisier. It certainly was a lot edgier. I kind of liked it. Maybe I liked it at the time because I was a teenager. I do feel that, you know, a lot of grounds at Old Trafford, for example, with all the health and safety laws, you can't stand up, you can't sit down, you can't do this, you mustn't, you know, that plays into it. The fact that the Premier League fans are, on average, the ones who actually go to games are the oldest in Europe, you know, that happens. I mean, once you get into your 40s, unless you're some kind of goon, you know, you tend to be do a little more sitting in your hands. The fact that it's difficult for teenagers and, you know, people in their early 20s who you would imagine would be the loudest passionate people to buy tickets because they're not going to go with mom and dad, and many of them can't afford to go on their own. All this stuff, I think, contributes to it. But I also wonder if there isn't also a fact that from a bottom line perspective, the people who own the game and try to make a buck off it really don't mind this situation.
I think they I don't know whether they do or not, but they should, because I think part of the Premier League selling point abroad has always been the backdrop. And the backdrop is the ultra-modern stadiums. You watch a game in Italy, the stadiums generally look a bit crumbly. Napoli always have that bottom tier empty, and it makes everything look terrible. Right. The top tier's got 50,000 people in it, tier is terrible.
It's an age-old thing.
I think that's hugely important to the way the Premier League looks. The fact that something looks important. If something looks important, people will believe that it is important.
But on television, though, you don't notice it as much. I mean, I watched...
No, that's true. That is true.
I watched the Chelsea QPR game on TV, and I could hear the QPR fans a little bit. I didn't notice any particular problem with Stamford Bridge the way maybe I might have noticed if I was there.
Do you know what the most telling thing is, actually? And the Chelsea Supporters Trust made this point, that away supports... are continually excellent.
Yeah.
Chelsea's away support is fantastic.
United, I will make an opinion. I will point something out in this which maybe not a lot of people know. So at Stamford Bridge, the away supporters used to sit in the East Stand, which was basically, it's the stand behind sort of the two manager dugouts. That was interesting because it meant that they were really quite close to the Matthew Harding stand, which is where Chelsea's noisier, more raucous support tends to sit. So you had this incredible sort of back and forth going on all the time, which I think really added to the atmosphere. And then it was felt, the Chelsea manager at the time, felt that having the away fans basically right in the East End meant that they were influencing calls when the ball went out of play and influencing the, you know, the referee could hear them, the linesman could hear them and whatever. So he had them moved to where they are now, which, like at most grounds, this is basically, it's a little slice in the corner. The manager who did that was one Jose Mourinho back in 2005. I'm wondering if that plays into it a little bit, that if you want your own fans to react, you know, they have to some degree, be able to engage the away fans. And when the loudest fans are sitting at opposite ends of the stadium, they can barely hear each other.
I think that is actually a factor, but maybe not for the reason that you mean. I think that there is a factor that fans now take more pleasure in the tension and the tribalism than in actually watching the football. I think that is, but that's not just true of Chelsea. I think it happens a lot.
But you would think that would make them noisier.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure it does. I think it makes them noisier in general in life, but I'm not sure it does in the course of an average Premier League game. You could also, the other thing we should probably mention is the standard of the football.
It's time for some quick hits. Southampton win again, sneaking past Hull with a bit of good fortune. Alisson, if the season began on August 30th, the way God intended, they'd be top of the league. We expect them to regress to some sort of mean. Are you seeing any signs that this is happening?
No. I think I was the only journalist in the country who said they might have a top four moment this season. And I'm really pleased to see them there. And I just love the way Ronald Koeman's reacted to it. In gradual stages, he's saying it's, you know, week by week, he gives a little more away, saying, yeah, you know, we're thinking about the Champions League. Well, good on them. Hope they get there.
That would be interesting. It takes them a while, but Arsenal eventually beat up Burnley, and their boss, Sean Dyche, says his team belong to a different market right now. Husey, you get to choose. You can either wax lyrical about Alexis Sanchez, whom match of the day compared to Luis Suarez, or you can tell us whether Burnley will ever be in the same market as Arsenal.
No, they won't. And I think you're talking about the quality of players you can buy, which is why they're bottom of the league and Arsenal at the other end. I love Sanchez. He's a top player, but I think people are getting a little bit carried away on the back of a few goals against Burnley and Sunderland. The match of the day poll in which he sort of was viewed as a better player than Eden Hazard, I thought was slightly odd, and compared to Suarez, I think is even stranger.
Charlie Austin scores again for QPR, who nearly hit the jackpot against Chelsea. Mourinho wasn't happy after the game, as we've discussed. But Rory, what did the visitors and Uncle Harry do right?
They worked hard. They were well organised. They took a chance when it became clear that Chelsea couldn't quite finish them off. I think it wasn't so much that QPR did a huge amount right. They did everything they had to do. Chelsea couldn't finish them off. They couldn't quite find that second goal that would have killed it. And then QPR were always going to have one moment. And they actually I think came out of that game probably with more hope than they went into it. I think it could be the sort of performance that kickstarts their season a little bit.
Wonder when the Austin for England chants start up. Ollie Kay reported last week that the European Clubs Association will ask FIFA to consider a Spring World Cup for Qatar 2022, which would mean the season wrapping up by early April at the latest. Allison, are you okay with that? Is it, as Ollie suggests, the least bad option out of a bunch of horrid ones?
Well, duh, yes.
Duh, Ollie.
UEFA are going for January. FIFA have opted for November. Premier League put their head in the sand. So, yeah, April, it's a compromise, but it's the best one. I mean, and is it so clever to come up with an idea that just means the minimum amount of disruption to the richest leagues in the world? No, it's not.
Swansea go down to 10 men against Everton, but nevertheless, Roberto Martinez's crew are held. Hughesy, we all praise Roberto, and this summer the club finally spent money too. So why are they stuck in mid-table?
And they're stuck there. I think they'll finish top six, seven, as expected. I think they've had some tough fixtures. They've got the Europa League to contend with, and it's a very unpredictable, competitive league. So I don't think you should sack him either yet, Gab.
Thank you. It's so unpredictable, of course, that, as I love reminding everybody, seven of the top eight have been the same in each of the last six seasons. Spurs conjure up a smash and grab at Aston Villa after Christian Benteke gets himself sent off and Harry Kane pulls off some last-ditch heroics. Rory, your thoughts on the red card and whether Kane should be getting some love from Uncle Roy. Also, while you're at it, tell me about why Harry Kane should be called up but Charlie Austin shouldn't.
Because Harry Kane plays for a more high-profile club, and that, as we all know, is the most important thing when considering England call-ups. I am uncomfortable with the image of Harry Kane getting some love from Uncle Roy. That sounds very upsetting. Is he good enough to play for England? Probably not.
You're so
not.
Narrow-minded.
Probably not. He's obviously in a rich vein of form. He gives the fans something. He lifts the fans. He runs around a lot. He's not. Harry Kane is not some sort of world-class striker in the making. But he's kind of doing the business, and I think in the context where Soldado and Adebayor aren't scoring, it is weird that Pochettino won't start him. Gab, we had El Clásico last week, and now this weekend it was Der Klassiker. Someone's written something in German that I can't pronounce.
Was passierte?
What happened in the game between Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund?
Thank you. What happened is Borussia Dortmund, in an absolute rut, they set up to basically defend, no centre forward, say we're going to hit you on the counter, and they did in the first half through Marco Reus. But the problem with Bayern Munich is they just have so many weapons. And even when Mario Götze has a stinker and Müller and Lewandowski aren't really getting it together, they just kept growing as the game went on. And a really entertaining match. And then Frank Ribery comes in at the end and basically wraps it up, helping set up Lewandowski and then winning the penalty, which Arjen Robben converts. Right. Any other business?
Yeah. I felt slightly uncomfortable watching Match of the Day 2 with Brad Friedel talking about Spurs, and he was being a little critical of Spurs individuals and questioning Pochettino a little, which is fantastic telly and the BBC must think fantastic. But if I was Pochettino, I would be angry that one of my players was doing that, and I'm wondering if anyone agrees with me that all it did for a viewer was make them feel slightly torn and uncomfortable, and should he be doing it?
My any other business is about Western Sydney Wanderers.
Yes!
Who won the Asian Champions League at the weekend, beating Al Hilal, the Saudi powerhouse, in what was the first Australian club ever to win the Asian Champions League, which is a much more important competition than people think it is. Extremely lucrative, and it's watched by millions and millions of people across Asia, which is a continent that has quite a few people on it. But most importantly, apart from the fact that Tony Popovich, Crystal Palace legend, is the Western Sydney Wanderers manager, they've only been around for 3 years, this is the moment when I think we have to cross Australia off the list of countries who don't like football. We now, that debate of when will football ever catch on in Australia, like we have it about America, now has to stop, full stop. It has basically dwindled, but it is now over. The Australians like football. That's my point.
And will the proof of that be when Popovich says no to Crystal Palace when they ask him to be their new manager?
I don't know if he would say no, but that would be an extremely... I'd put money on that happening at some point.
Right, that's all we've got time for this week. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes and Player FM, please do so immediately. I'm going to thank my guests today, but first I'm going to thank again Dave McGuire and Gary Jacob, who really saved our bacon last weekend. You're writing something down. Are you writing down, Dave? What are you writing down? Like, to edit that out, because he's modest. You're going to edit the bit about you. Are you going to decide on Gary Jacob's behalf to be modest as well? Yeah, he will. That's the problem with people with red hair. Anyway, thanks to my guest today, the outstanding Matt Hughes, on his way for a tete-a-tete with Arsene Wenger, Rory K. Smith here in the studio, and, of course, Alison Rudd. Check out thetimes.co.uk. If you're a member, you get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. And if you're not a member yet, for just £1, you can take our digital trial today. £1, less than it costs to use the loo in some fancy train stations in some fancy countries. So all you need to do is search Time Sport online. Till next week, bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Hi, I'm Tim Montgomery, the presenter of another Times podcast from the opinion pages called Did You Read? It's the perfect weekly snapshot of some of the best writing in the newspaper. Find out more by heading to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and search Did You Read to subscribe on iTunes.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.